is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
If you go to a college practice, even if you go to NBA practices, and I've been fortunate to be able to go to Cavs training camp a couple of times, and you know, those guys will tell you, even at the highest level, the fundamentals are the fundamentals and the basics of the game and your footwork is really what everything is built off of. So, and until you master that, it doesn't matter how many cones you can dribble through or how many balls you can dribble at once and what you can do. If you can't catch square, pivot off both feet, you know, attack and create space off of just a few dribbles, all that other stuff isn't really going to matter.
Tony DeCesar just completed his fifth season as the boys' varsity head coach at Solon High School in the state of Ohio. In 2018, Coach DeCesar led the Comets to the Division I state championship game and finished as the state runner-up. He was an assistant coach at Solon for three seasons prior to taking over the program in 2014. Tony started his high school career as an assistant to Coach Bob Patton at Westlake High School in Ohio for 3 years, followed by 1 year on the girls' side at Lakeside High School prior to arriving at Solon. Tony played his high school basketball for Coach Brian Becker at St. Ignatius from 1996 to 1999, and then went on to play his college basketball at Wittenberg University in Springfield, Ohio. Would you like to become a certified hoophead? Jason and I would like to invite you to visit our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/hoopheadspod. The link will be in the show notes. We're approaching the one-year anniversary of the show, and we've already dropped over 100 episodes with some of the top minds in the game of basketball, from the grassroots all the way up to the NBA. Many of our listeners have reached out directly asking for bonus content, transcripts, Q&A opportunities, Hoopheads Pod swag, and other extra perks. We're now offering you the chance to contribute to the growth and production of our show. Jason and I pour a lot of time and energy into recording and producing two or three podcasts per week for you to enjoy and to help grow the game of basketball. If you love the show, please consider supporting our mission at the $3 per month level, which will enable us to at least tell our families the podcast is bringing in some revenue for all that time we're spending. If you really want to help, as a certified hoophead for $10 per month, you will not only have our eternal gratitude, but you will have access to never-before-released bonus material, plus your very own official Hoopheads Pod t-shirt that will be the envy of all your friends. To start, we are offering our $10 per month supporters downloadable transcripts of every episode so you don't get in a car wreck trying to take notes, an official Hoopheads Pod t-shirt, a podcast shout-out to our new monthly patrons, plus a mention in the show notes, access to an online community of coaches like you who are dedicated listeners of the podcast and will be able to answer your questions and share their coaching experiences, a monthly episode with Mike, Jason, and other special guests talking about the previous month's episodes and answering some of the FAQs that we received that month, Q&A calls so you can ask your own questions of us or our coaches, plus 10% off all Head Start basketball camps, training, and merchandise. Thank you for all of your support since we launched the show, and a special huge thank you to all of you who decide to become a part of Hoopheads Nation, our patrons, who will enable us to take the Hoopheads Pod to a whole nother level. Get ready to listen and learn as you enjoy this episode with Coach Tony DeCesar from Solon High School in the state of Ohio.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome the boys' head varsity coach from Solon High School, Tony DeCesar, to the podcast. Tony, welcome.
Matt, thanks for having me on.
We are very excited to get a chance to talk to you, delve into your basketball journey. And we're going to start out with your getting into the game as a kid. Can you talk a little bit about what made you fall in love with the game of basketball when you were younger?
Yeah, you know, probably similar to a lot of other guys, played everything as a kid, you know, baseball, basketball, football, soccer, but was fortunate to have my dad as my coach for just about everything growing up. And that was, you know, that was special and got me interested in a lot of different sports. But truthfully, for basketball, it was the one that I had a lot of success at, and it's the one I seem to enjoy the most. You know, part of it was, you know, his company had season tickets to the Cavs, so I got to go down there in the Mark Price and Craig Elo days and back at the old Richfield Coliseum and see those games. So it was a lot of exposure through, you know, growing up around the game and having a dad who was a grade school coach and AAU coach, and that kind of exposure to it.
All right, I got to ask you a Cavs question then here. Yeah. So what's your recollection of the Coliseum versus the Q?
So the two things I remember, especially when I was young, was that long drive once you got off the highway waiting to get to the arena. And and really just how enjoyable the games were when the Cavs were good back then. You know, I think as an adult, you enjoy it to some level, but as a kid, it was just so magical to be down there when they were good and they were fun. And as you know, you get to see all the greats and Jordan's coming to town and Reggie Miller and those guys, you know, those were the things that really stood out to me.
Yeah.
The Coliseum seemed like forever away when you're a kid, just wanting to watch some ball. When you got there, it was something that I really enjoyed as a kid.
So obviously I'm a little younger than you get. I mean, I was born in 86, so okay. I don't know. But I remember when I went in like the early 90s with my dad, I just remember thinking that it like took a 2-hour journey to get to the Coliseum, because I don't really, I mean, I know that getting to that general location now is relatively easy because of the turnpike and 8 and things, but I think back then it was not easy to go, right?
At least that's the way it felt, and maybe that's just the way you remember it as a kid.
And then I think
you were in the car forever.
The transition to the queue was like, oh man, coming from Strongsville, it's like 15 minutes to get downtown. So it's like, it was way quicker. I don't know.
I remember sitting in the parking lot after games trying to get out of there and always having Joe Tate and listening to the post-game show. That's one of the things I remember. Yeah. And then I remember when they were bad and being able to go down there, you know, and you'd buy a ticket in the upper bowl, and before you know it, I'd be sitting like 5 rows behind the bench.
They have 10-cent beer night at those games or not?
No, they didn't. But when they were terrible. So I remember that. And then when they were good, I just remember how loud it was, you know, in the playoffs when Price and Doherty and those guys were there. It was just a great building. To me, it was a great building to be able to watch NBA games in. So I have nothing but great memories of going out to the Coliseum with the Cavs for sure.
Yeah, I do too. And I think the NBA was so cool at that time with some of the Eastern Conference teams and some of the stars that were coming through. So to be able to go see those guys play, you know, really made me fall in love with the game.
Yeah, and I think it's fun to be able to kind of, you know, you're out on your driveway, you're in the gym and you're kind of working on your game, and you're able to emulate some of those players of that particular time. And as a kid, especially when you can see them live, you know, I think we kind of take for granted being here in Cleveland that you can see an NBA game, and you go some places in the United States where they don't necessarily have a pro team or even a major college team. And those kids don't always get the chance to see the players that we got to see in person. They only have to watch them on TV.
Yeah, it's such a different experience. And I know the one thing I always remember was, for whatever reason, the Pacers always seemed to come to town on my birthday. So Reggie Miller became my favorite player. I think I played 1,000 games of one-on-one in the driveway against imaginary Reggie Miller. and just little things like that really kind of endeared me to the game and got me hooked on it.
Yeah, it's cool being able to go into your imagination. I think that's one of the best things about the game of basketball is that you can do it on your own. You can invent scenarios. You can play against pros in your mind, and you don't need anybody else out there. And that to me is a huge, huge benefit of the game of basketball to a kid.
Real quick question. Do you like Reggie Miller, the basketball announcer?
No, I don't.
Okay, very good. I just want to clarify that. Make sure we're separating the two things here.
Yeah, I can separate the two. And it's funny to think he was my favorite player and one of my least favorite announcers, especially when he's doing these college games.
Yeah, when you have these NBA games on doing the college games and they don't know.
I think Weber's been okay.
Weber's been decent, but still, they just don't have the same depth of knowledge. And not that I do, but I think I think when you look back to when I was a kid, I knew every college team, every college player. I knew guys that were coming out of high school that, you know, were the national players. And I used to read the Blue Ribbon College Basketball Yearbook, which probably even predates both of you. And, it would have like the top 50 players and have a big, long bio on each one of them. And I knew all that stuff. And then today, I just, as busy as we are, I just don't have the time to follow college basketball as closely as certainly as I would like to. And as I did when I was a kid. But, when you get a chance to emulate those players, I think that's something that inspires you when you're a young kid. You mentioned, Tony, that you grew up playing all different sports. So just as a high school coach, what's your perspective on multi-sport athletes? Because I know there's always a little bit of a battle between high school coaches that, you know, want their kids obviously around as much as they can be. And yet I think there's a lot of evidence that having multi-sport athletes is also a positive. So where do you fall on that spectrum, obviously, with your own background of growing up and playing a bunch of different sports?
Yeah, you know, I'd like to encourage kids to do as much as they can for a number of reasons. I think it's really good to get away from your basketball coaches, because if you're only a basketball guy, the high schools turn into a year round. You know, we have the 2 30-day periods where we don't get to do anything or aren't allowed to. Other than that, there's guys I spend 4 or 5 days a week with 10 months of the year. And I think once you get to the season, times they've heard a lot of your voice, and they frankly can be a little bit sick of hearing your voice. So, and I think hearing different perspectives, being coached in different ways, and really being in different roles for guys is kind of eye-opening. And one experience I always cite with our guys is Sincere Carey decided his senior year to play football, hadn't played since seventh grade. And my first thought was, oh, God, is he going to get hurt?
There's a broken collarbone waiting to happen, right?
Just, you know, we kept our fingers crossed every day he took that football field. But I really think it was a great thing for him because, you know, he had always been the best player on the court probably his entire life, but certainly from the moment he stepped onto Solon. And not that he didn't have to work for it because he was an incredibly hard worker, but football was a very different experience for him where he wasn't the guy where things didn't revolve around him. And, you know, I think he came away from that a much – you know, more mature leader. And I think it really helped us on the basketball court. At a school like Solon, you know, I don't think we have the luxury to just have single sport athletes. And while we're a bigger school, you know, for all of our teams to be successful, which is, you know, you're friends with the coaches, you know the coaches, you root for them, you want them to have the kind of success because you know the time they pour into it. I would never encourage a guy not to do another sport. You know, I think what a lot of times happens is we get guys in as freshmen and they're going to do three sports, which I think is awesome. And maybe by the time they're sophomores, they recognize that, man, the commitment to do that is tough. And we get a lot of guys who dial it back to two. And when we frankly, we do have a lot of just basketball guys in our program. But those multi-sport athletes, I think, you know, they're breathing competition year round and not just training. And I think that does a great job of carryover, especially with our football program. You know, we get some of those guys who just have a different, I don't want to say, you know, our basketball guys aren't tough, but those football guys have they're just a different kind of mean streak to them that I love to have on the basketball court.
And I think one thing, too, is that when you have, obviously Solon's had a very successful football program as well. So when you have that success in other sports, you're also breeding some of the same characteristics that you want as a basketball coach. You're breeding some of that toughness and some of that leadership and some of that being a good teammate stuff. That's all a part of being successful, no matter what the sport is. And when you get kids that are exposed to different coaches, different methodologies in terms of how they go about creating that type of team environment, I think that's always a benefit to, you know, whatever sport the kid is in at the moment.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think it ever hurts a kid to be a part of a winning sports program. You know, whether he's the star, whether he's a starter, or whether he's just a guy that's a part of the team, there's things you're going to see and witness that all winning programs, winning cultures have in common. And to bring those back to the next sport and to share those with the next group of athletes you're going to be on a team with, you know, I think is huge. And so on, I'm fortunate. I've coached in a number of different places. Our football coach, Jim McQuaid, shares athletes, never discourages kids from playing other sports, doesn't view football on a pedestal, where I know a lot of coaches that I talk to, they have that challenge of battling for athletes. And that's just something we've never had to deal with in Solon. The coaches, they get it. It's about the kid and the experience, and you want them to do as much as they can. Because frankly, after 4 years, maybe they'll play one sport if they're lucky, but most will never play a sport again in that kind of competitive way. So you never want to discourage a kid from having that experience.
Yeah, I love what you just said. I love what you just said there about it being about the kid and the experience. And I think that's something that, you know, unfortunately you hear too often that coaches forget about. And, you know, I tell people all the time that if you want to be a one sport athlete, that's great. If it's driven by the kid who wants to be the one sport athlete, tremendous. If you want to be a basketball player year round and that's what you want to do and it's driven by the kid, you know, fantastic. What I worry about is when you hear about, you know, kind of to your point, what you described is when you hear about that coach that is discouraging their players from playing in other sports or, you know, puts undue pressure on a kid and their family to only be at, you know, whatever the one sport is that they're playing. That's where I think you get into a problem because, like you said, most of these kids are not going to even be able to play one sport in college, and most of them are going to be done by the time their senior year is over. That's going to be the last time they're going to probably play organized athletics. And so to take away a kid's opportunity by putting pressure on them as an adult coach, I think is just, you know, you're walking down a slippery slope there for sure.
Yeah. You know, when you hear a kid say he only wants to play one sport, especially when they're middle school or freshman, that's typically not coming from a kid. You know, kids want to be a part of sports. They want to play, they want to have fun. And who knows when you're 14 years old, what your passion is going to be. You know, we've had exactly. Guys that have come in as basketball players and, you know, by the time they're juniors and seniors, they're focused on a different sport when basketball was what maybe their reputation was when they came into school. And we've had the flip side of it where, you know, just this past year, we had a couple guys that were freshman football players, came out for basketball and really fell in love with the sport and being a part of the team. And, you know, now they tell me that's what their focus is going to be moving forward. So, you know, give kids as many opportunities as they can to find out where they're enjoying enjoyment's going to lie. And I was lucky to do that. And I think maybe that's where that perspective comes from. I ran track, I ran cross country, I played basketball, played baseball, played football. And, you know, you get to high school and maybe you can't do them all, but you try, and then you kind of figure out where your heart lies.
What else did you do besides hoops at Ignatius?
So I ran cross country for a few years. My freshman year was frankly something forced upon me. I had no interest in doing it, but it was something I actually had a little bit of talent in. And, you know, my parents said, you're going to do a fall sport. You want to join the football team or you want to run? And, you know, I looked at some of the guys of those 125 freshmen at Ignatius, and I said, well, I don't want them hitting me. So
that's right.
I did cross country, and I actually, you know, I found that I enjoyed being a part of the team. And it was something, by the time I was a junior, I was running varsity, and we were a part of a team that finished second in the state. And that experience is something that, you know, I can look back on so fondly. So I was appreciative to have parents that maybe pushed me towards something or maybe forced me to do something that maybe I didn't think I would really enjoy. So I did that for 2 years, my freshman year. And then I didn't run my sophomore year because I was really focused on trying to make varsity as a sophomore, which back then was maybe a little harder or less
common.
You know, less common than it is now. And then I came back and did it my junior year and was part of a team that had a lot of success. And I ran track for a couple of years, but that was probably the toughest one because spring basketball was starting to become big with the AAU circuit. And, you know, basketball was where my passion was. So, you know, I did a year of that and just really didn't have time for it after that. But I got to, you know, I got to play for Coach Becker and run for a guy named Frank Jancura, who won multiple state championships, and then be on a track team coached by, you know, Chico Kyle. So it was, you know, I got to learn from a bunch of different guys and be a part of some really great teams.
Funny story. I ran for Frank Jancura cross country at Stronzo when he coached with Kozma. Yeah. And 2001 to 2003.
He was okay. There. So it wasn't all that much after I left.
And he actually lives in my neighborhood still to this day.
Small world.
I know, right?
Well, you got to learn.
And I think fondly of my time with him. He might disagree, and he may have some different stories. I know I was a bit of a knucklehead, and you know, he was such a diehard cross country guy, and really had a team full of those guys. And I was kind of the outcast in that way. That, you know, I was a little bit talented, and I ran because it was fun. And I liked being around the guys, but I bet I made him scratch his head a few times.
We won't ask you to go into any more detail on those stories, but you got to learn. You got to learn from some really great coaches, being exposed to obviously to Coach Becker and then Coach Kyle as well, who's obviously had tremendous success on the football side of things and track as well. What do you remember? What did you learn from either of those guys that you still look back on now in your current state as a coach?
You know, the one thing that I always appreciated from Coach Becker and I try to do with my guys is the freedom he gave me as a player. You know, he understood where I thought my strengths were, and he allowed me to play to those. You know, he never really pigeonholed me and told me, you know, this is your role. You're going to do these things. He let me go out and try to make plays and be the player that I thought I wanted to be. And then from there, you can kind of define the roles with what's successful and what isn't. But, you know, I really enjoyed playing for him because he had so much confidence in his guys, and he gave you so much freedom to go out there and to make plays and be, you know, to be a playmaker. So, you know, that was one of the things I took from him. And then I thought he did a really good job in a time where, you know, maybe it wasn't stressed as much, but I looked at him as a player's coach. You know, he had high standards, he had a high accountability, but, you know, I never left the gym thinking he didn't care about me. You know, even when he was telling me the things that I didn't want to hear, but that I needed to hear as a player. And there were a lot of those when I was a teenager. I always left knowing that him and his staff, they cared about their team. So you try to take things like that and maybe, you know, I'm almost 40, so it's 20 years ago. Do I glorify or am I misremembering things? But, you know, I remember him being genuine and really having belief and care for his guys.
Yeah, I think when you're a coach, if you can do that, and we've heard that kind of universally from everybody that we've talked to, that if you can get your players to understand that you care about them as more than just basketball players, but you truly are interested in what's going on in their lives, whether it's at school or at home or with their families or whatever the case might be, it makes such a difference when you then go to try to push them and get the most out of them. They're much more receptive to that than they are with somebody who motivates by fear, which, again, I don't think that that's around as much as it used to be. I think probably when I was a kid and probably even when you were a kid, that may have been a little bit more prevalent. Nowadays, I think especially with social media and just all the things, we saw what happened with Tom Izzo and he yelled at a kid, that there was that big furor about, oh my gosh, I can't believe he's yelling at a player. you know, it's just, I think it's a different time. It's a different time, a different era, and coaching has evolved in a different way where kind of what you described with Coach Becker is more, I think, the norm than it used to be.
Yeah, and I think it's what kids, I don't know if it's what they need, but I think it's the best way to reach them. And I think there is a time and place for, you know, what Coach Izzo did. You know, maybe at the high school level, you can't challenge a guy at the center of the court with your finger in his face. You may, that doesn't fly as much. But, you know, what he did was hold a guy accountable for not reaching their standards. And you can debate whether, you know, his method was appropriate. But, you know, the one thing you keep hearing from Izzo's guys and that you hope you hear from the guys you coach is, we accept that from him because we know he loves us. And if it wasn't that way, you'd see him losing guys to transfers. You'd see his players speaking out against him. So, you know, I think you could take a snapshot of any coach, their worst moment, and make them out to be something. But, you know, your guys will let you know where you stand with them. And Izzo's guys, I think, really stood up for him in a time where he was getting attacked for, you know, what I think a lot of people, especially the older school coaches, would say really wasn't much of anything.
Right. And I think if you played sports at a high level, I think you understand that those kinds of things happen. And everybody has their own style. And Tom Izzo's style maybe isn't the same as another coach's style. And it may not even be the style that some players would want to play under. But I think everybody who's played sports at a high level has had a similar experience where a coach is, again, holding you accountable, a coach is being demanding, a coach is yelling. And if you haven't been in a situation where a coach is yelling, then you probably haven't played athletics at a very high level.
No, and I think the higher the level, the more you see some of that, because guys' livelihoods are at stake, and sometimes that brings out a lot of emotion. But, you know, I was watching the games with a lot of other coaches and former players, and, you know, the sentiment of going around the room was, we wished our college coaches were as nice in that moment as Izzo was.
Yeah, right, exactly. I can vouch for that.
There was a tweet, Mike and I talked about it before, was they said something along the lines of, like, if you thought that was bad, you should be around NBA players during halftime film sessions when they're looking at film in the middle of halftime and yelling at each other and getting in each other's faces for not breakdowns. So I thought that was funny.
It's amazing. You think back, and, you know, it's been a while since I read Season on the Brink, but you think about that book, and if that book were to be published today about a current college coach, like within 30 seconds of that book being published, that guy is fired.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a bestseller.
Yeah.
And it was, and I remember reading that when I was younger, and I never batted an eye at any of the things he was said, but I know this, if I had any one of those locker room speeches at Solon High School,
right,
I wouldn't be coaching the next day, and I probably wouldn't be teaching either. So, you know, times
exactly.
Have changed, and I think it's important to try to change with it. And I think there's ways where you can still have those high standards and still demand excellence from your guys, and as much as possible do it without demeaning them. Because, you know, once you start to hurt that relationship, especially guys, you know, they don't like being called out in front of their teammates. They don't like when the voice gets raised. You see the shoulders slump and you see the head go down. And sometimes no longer is the message even being received. All they're hearing is, man, coach is on me again. So, you know, there's ways to do it. And certainly there's times where the voice needs to be raised and players need to be challenged. But as much as possible, you know, you can have the standards without having, you know, any negative impact to the relationship with players.
Yeah, and I think when you do that, you're going to end up getting the most out of your kids. And you have to also, I think, coach to your personality. And so everybody's different in the way that they go about doing things. And obviously, as you get to know your kids, you know who can take more of that challenge on and who maybe needs a little bit softer touch in order to get the most out of. Because ultimately, as the coach, your goal is to get the most out of each kid. And if it's just like teaching or anything else when you're dealing with relationships, you can't treat everybody and do everything exactly the same way with every person that you meet. You have different ways of handling different people. And I think a coach who's a good coach really knows their kids and understands what it is that each one of them needs to get the most and the maximum out of each individual player.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point, is that whether you have 10, 12, 15 guys, they're 15 different guys, and what works with one might not work for another. And the better you know your guys, you know, the better approach you have. But the other thing you said, and I think you hit the nail on the head, is you have to be yourself. You know, I would love to be Brad Stevens on the sideline with no reactions, complete focus, never up and down. he is my model, my role model. I don't know how he does it. I usually last about 10 seconds into the game before that goes out the window, and the emotions and the enthusiasm and, and those things take over. But, you know, I think the kids can tell if you're fake pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to be someone you're not or something you're not, that's going to shine through as well. So, you know, I got good advice when I got my first head coaching job from a guy that I think I learned as much from as anyone in coaching. And he said, don't try to be me. You got to be you. You know, what works for me may not work for you. The things that I've done may not be the way you do things. Just try to take what I, you know, what made us successful and do it in your own way. And I've really took that to heart.
So let's jump into that question. Who are some of the people that you consider to be your mentors in the coaching profession?
You know, I always start with the first guy I worked for, a guy named Bob Patton, who coached at Westlake High School, Kenston, did a year at Solon, was a player at Stanford, and was a former Mr. Basketball. When I got into coaching, you know, probably like a lot of people, I played at high school, I played in college, I thought I had this high level of understanding for the game, and I was fortunate to get on his staff. And when you walk in the gym and you see, you know, what a seasoned coach looks like and what he does in practice, I realized pretty quickly I knew next to nothing.
It's a big difference being a player and a coach. There's no question about that.
You try to explain that to your guys and even to some of the parents in your program that, you know, I know you follow the game, but there's just such a depth of knowledge that these high school coaches have, and they never really get credit for. But it was an eye-opening experience. And I would say 90% of what I do as a coach, I learned from Bob. I took from Bob. He was phenomenal in building a program, building relationships, developing players. And he did a great job of letting me as an assistant and all of his assistants be a part of really every aspect of the program, from parent meetings to practice planning to off season to scheduling. So I got an apprenticeship under a guy I think was as good as any in the game. And to me, that's the best way to grow as a coach. You know, I was very, very fortunate to be in that position just by luck. You know, you could coach for a long time and still not learn what I did in a couple of years under a guy who does it at a real high level. And I would tell any young coach, when you're getting in the game, you want to move up the ladder as quickly as possible, but find a guy who does it and does it at a high level and spend a couple of years on that staff, and you'll be blown away at how much you grow during that time. So, you know, he's who I started under, and he's who I learned the most from. And certainly, you know, we've stayed close. We're good friends today. But I tell him as much as I can. The success we've had at Solon is a lot attributed to what I learned under him when I was one of his assistants at Westlake High School.
What would you say is one of the biggest differences, changes that you've noticed for yourself and how you started out your first year as a coach to kind of where you are now?
You know, I think as a first year coach, and I was actually thinking about this the other day, I was pretty bad as a first year head coach, but I didn't think so in the moment. You know, you think you're doing everything right. You got this, it's your first job and you're ready for it. And, you know, I think I lived and died with every minute of every practice and every second of every game. And I really thought our performances were a direct reflection of my ability as a coach. And, you know, some of that's good to have because it drives you to work hard and to be successful. But some of it's just unrealistic. You got a team full of teenagers who have different ability levels, and they're going to perform how they perform. And you try to put them in the best position they can to be successful. But I was too, you know, overly hyped. I had maybe too driven to a way where I think it wasn't enjoyable at times for the players. You know, you suck the fun out of the gym at times, trying to get them to a place that really maybe you couldn't get to in 1 year. And I wanted to go from when I took over at Solon, I was their fourth head coach in 5 years. And it was a complete from the studs rebuild. And that's nothing against the guys that came before. But when you have that kind of turnover, you just don't have any foundation, and the kids don't know the coaches, and there's no level of trust in the community. So, you know, I wanted to go from rebuild to state contender in a year. And I approached every day like that. And it probably wasn't the best thing for the kids. And I'll give some of my guys a ton of credit in exit interviews at the end of the year. I asked for honest feedback, and they gave it to me and said, you know, here's some things that you can do to make this a more enjoyable experience for us. You know, things like shortening practices the year goes on. You know, things like, you know, not putting us on the baseline for all these different little mistakes that, you know, you grow up, and that's what in college, that's what happened. I spent my whole freshman year on the baseline, and I thought that was coaching. And, you know, as you move on and you learn there's other ways to reach guys. So, you know, I think that the biggest growth is just how you treat the kids and how you maybe your perspective as someone who's done it, and not even for a long time, but, you know, after 5 years, you know, I realize our record isn't necessarily how I'm going to be remembered as a coach, and not really even how I want to be remembered as a coach. So you try to pour more time into the relationships, into the kids, and less time into maybe the film and the the practice planning and the driving guys so hard where, you know, it maybe isn't as important to every player as it is to the coaches, and try to remember that as you move throughout the year.
Yeah, that's hard to remember. I think any coach, you know, you live and die with it. And I know that, you know, I'm speaking for myself, and I'm sure just based on what little I know about you at this point, that, you know, you would feel the same way. But as a player, you know, you take it really hard, and it meant the world to me when I was playing, and it still does to this day. But not every kid feels that way. Not every kid on your team is spending the next 24 hours after a loss, you know, going back and replaying every single thing that happened in the game and figuring out how they can play better 5 minutes later. They're wondering what they're going to order at McDonald's.
Yeah, isn't that the truth, after that game ends, and by the time they walk out of the locker room, they've moved on to the next thing. And I, you know, I in some ways I wish I had that ability to just, you know, all right, it's over. Let's focus on the next thing. You know, the poor coaches are up till 1 a.m. trying to figure out what was screwed up during the game, and the kids have moved on and they're enjoying their life. So, you know, I think maybe taking myself and taking the job, I don't want to say less seriously, because, man, I hate to lose, and I really enjoy the success our program's had and the success our kids have brought to Solon basketball. But, you know, it isn't as important to every individual as it will be to the coaches who live and breathe it. And it's, and I think over the last couple of years, looking back on, you know, my first year as a head coach, I knew all the things about, you know, let's have high standards, let's hold players accountable, let's do these things to develop players. But, you know, maybe the approach and how I went about those things wasn't the best. So, you know, there's a way to have all those things and to still do it where you're doing it right by the kids. And I think that's probably been the biggest adjustment.
So you mentioned one or two things, obviously not having the kids run for every tiny little mistake. And, you know, you also mentioned maybe cutting down practice time. I laughed when you said that, because when I was at Richmond Heights with Phil Schmuck, and we started out, and at the time, I think Phil, when I got my teaching job at Richmond Heights, I think I was 25, and Phil was maybe 32 at the time, and I was single, and we'd have these like 3.5-hour practices.
Oh yeah.
And then we'd sit around the coach's office after that for another, you know, hour and a half. And, you know, I look back on that time like, man, it was nice to have all that time. But then you think about it from the kid's perspective, and you think about really what the value of, you know, after you get by like 2 hours, like I would like to see a video of what the last hour and a half of that practice looked like.
Oh,
and
yeah.
see what value we were really getting out of it at that point.
Is that where you learned continuous knockout?
Yeah, there you go. You know, it's just,
yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And it was something that, you know, you learn as a coach, sometimes less is more. And some of my assistants still give me a hard time. Our second year we were playing St. Ignatius in the regionals, and we had a practice at Cleveland State the day before, and we're doing baseline transition drills, and we're going up and down, and we're competing as hard as I think we need to compete. And, you know, 2 years later, we're back in that situation, and we do 30 minutes of shooting and 15 minutes of film. So, you know, you learn sometimes through mistakes, and you learn sometimes through, you know, talking to players. But I think that's also that old school versus maybe new school approach, where 3.5-hour practice was just the norm when we played, and maybe when we even started coaching. And, you know, now after December hits, we won't go more than 90 minutes. And that's including shooting, because guys, you know, you'd rather have them fresh and enjoying their time. You just see that glazed look on their face if you stay in the gym too long.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start basketball camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
In today's world, there's so much more information out there than there was even 10 years ago about just the need for rest and recovery and how important it is if you're going to get the best out of yourself as a player, or you're going to get the best out of your players as a coach, that you need to take into account that rest and recovery time. And it's not just about grinding them down to the bone and working them as hard as you possibly can. You know, sometimes as, you know, you look back on coaching career, I look back on my playing experience and some of those things that, you know, you look at it now and you're like, gosh, I had to be tired when going through that, or my players had to be tired. I don't know how I could have been performing at my absolute peak when, you know, we were still practicing for 2.5 hours, day before a game. And to your point, I think that when you evolve as a coach, you just give your kids more opportunity to be successful. And you understand also that you mentioned it with Coach Becker, that you're kind of giving the kids a little bit more control over the situation as a coach. If you're going to practice, 2 hours the day before a game, that tends to be more about the coach as opposed to about the players. And I think that's where you get into danger.
Yeah, I think the coaching ego takes over sometimes and you feel like you got to do A, B, and C and you have to do it to have your kids ready. And the truth is, in a 2 hour practice, if you're spending it all on your opponent, they're going to take away 10 or 15 minutes of it anyway. So you're doing it to please yourself and not to really prepare the kids. And those are good things to learn. And, you know, I've been coaching 13 years, but I've only been a head coach for 5 of those. And, you know, I think of how much I've grown in those 5 years and hopefully where I'll be 5 years from now and 5 years from then. And, you know, and that's the important part is if you're going to ask the kids to continuously put in time in the weight room and on skills and develop as a player, you got to do that self-assessment as a coach, and you got to read and you got to talk to other coaches and go to clinics and find every opportunity you can to be a better version of yourself the next year for the student athletes that you're in charge of.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's another thing that's, I don't know if it's changed so much as it's just been more popularized in terms of having a growth mindset and really working at your craft. You don't see nearly as many coaches who are set in their ways and that, hey, this is the system I run. This is what we're going to do no matter what. Doesn't matter what my personnel is. And, you're not going to listen to anybody else. And you kind of think you're up on this pedestal. I think now people are much more open to being able to collaborate and, to your point, go to clinics, read books, talk to other coaches. One of the things that I find to be interesting, and, you know, our podcast kind of, you know, dives into this a little bit, is that, you know, now you can be friends with somebody in California and connect with them all the time and be able to ask them questions and bounce ideas off of them. And it's not somebody necessarily that you're going to compete against, because obviously you're friends with guys that are here in Cleveland, but by the same token, you know, they're going to be guys that you may end up competing against. So if you can talk to somebody in another state or somebody that you're never going to compete against directly, it's a lot easier to be open and just say, hey, this is a situation that we have, or here's something that we're doing that's working well. And I think that's that type of collaboration, again, because through the internet, just wasn't possible, 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think one of the great things about, at least with the basketball coaching fraternity, and I'd imagine it's the same in a lot of others, that there's never been a coach I've called at the high school or college level that hasn't opened their practices to me, talked to me about what they do defensively or offensively that makes them successful, or what they do in terms of player development. And then, through the internet, through podcasts like yours, through companies like Championship Productions, there's literally nothing you can't learn about the game if you're willing to spend the money or take the time to do it. And that's, one of the great things. If you really enjoy the game, you want that. You want those opportunities to continue to grow as a coach. And it's one of the things I enjoy most is, the season ends, I'm already talking to college coaches about what can I come see in the spring, and I'm already wasting all my money on new videos from Championship Productions and planning on clinics and those kind of things. Because if you love the game, those are you're talking hoops. When would you turn down that opportunity? So
for sure.
Yeah.
Who are some of the college coaches that you reach out to and talk a little bit about maybe what you've learned from one or two of them, either by going to practice or just having conversations?
Typically every fall before our season starts, I'll plan to see 3 colleges. And sometimes, maybe I'll pick up some of the local ones. So like this past season, I went to Cleveland State, I went to Oakland University, and I went to University of Michigan. And really only to see something different. And when I walked into the University of Michigan's practice, within 5 minutes, you can just see the difference. Really even from other colleges, the level of energy, the enthusiasm that comes from their coaches and players, the attention to detail. But one of the things I was blown away by in John Beilein's practice was how much they focused on just the basics. 20 minutes in, they hadn't done anything besides pass, catch, square up, jump stop finishes, things that sometimes my players will look at me sideways when I say we're gonna work on this. Well, those guys are playing at the highest level in college basketball, and that's what they're working on. And one of the other great things was they have the assistant coach, Luke Yaklik, who is kind of their defensive coordinator. There was a group of coaches waiting to go into practice, and he walked up and introduced himself and said, anyone need anything when this ends, I'll stay as long as you need to. I'll talk as much as you want to. I was a high school coach, and I want to help high school coaches. So we watched the two-hour practice and probably stayed for another 2 hours just talking ball and talking about defensive drills and philosophies and teaching points. So, you know, I've been very fortunate. No one's ever closed their doors to me. You know, I've spent a number of weekends down at West Virginia watching a Coach Hugs and his pressure defense, because that's something we do a lot of at Solon. And, you know, it's great to go around and see what other people do. And I think it really gets you excited for your season when you're watching these other guys do their job too.
Yeah, one of the things that I find to be amazing is the fact that no matter how much you think you know about the game, about certain drills, about ways of practicing and helping your players to improve, whenever you see somebody new, there's always a twist. There's always something a little bit different. There's always a tweak. There's always something new that you didn't think of, and you look at it and you're like, oh, that's a great idea. Why did I never think of that? And especially at the college level, you know, it's such a difference. Even, you know, you think about yourself as a high school coach, and obviously you're teaching during the school day, and, you know, I'm sure your mind drifts to basketball occasionally during the school day
maybe
while you're
twice.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure that happens occasionally, but the reality is that, you know, you're not 24 hours a day a basketball coach. And when you get to the college level, you are. And one of the things that I found to be interesting when we've talked to college coaches, and especially we've talked to a couple who have made a transition from a high school to a college coach, is just now the amount of time that you can spend doing the X's and O's, doing the planning, doing the scouting, doing the film work and all that stuff, which as a high school coach, you're doing it late at night, or you're doing, you know, all, you know exactly what I'm talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so to be able to focus on it 24 hours a day, and then when you go and you watch a college practice, you just see how meticulous it is and how well planned out it is, and just the variety of drills and the focus and attention to detail that goes on at a college practice is, I think, a lot of times eye-opening. One of the things that I always find and thought was interesting when we had an opportunity to take our team to watch a college practice, and just to give them an idea, a sense of kind of what it takes to play at that level. And also, I like the fact that, you know, you saw at Michigan, they're working on very basic, simple things. And I know that even, you know, I'm coaching my son's seventh grade AAU team, and, you know, we'll work on, you know, jump stops, reverse pivots, and just simple footwork. And a lot of times, to your point, they, you know, they're looking at you like, coach, you know, why are we doing this? And they forget that those basic principles, those basic fundamentals are what everything else is built on.
Yeah, you know, it might not be the most enjoyable thing to do, but if you go to a college practice, even if you go to NBA practices, and I've been fortunate to be able to go to Cavs training camp a couple of times, and you know, those guys will tell you, even at the highest level, the fundamentals are the fundamentals, and the basics of the game and your footwork is really what everything is built off of. So, and until you master that, it doesn't matter how many cones you can dribble through or how many balls you can dribble at once, and what you can do. If you can't catch square, pivot off both feet, you know, attack and create space off of just a few dribbles, all that other stuff isn't really going to matter. So, you know, it's always reassuring to see guys at a higher level who do it better than I do it, focusing on some of the things that we think are important in our program. And, you know, it's great to get to go see that. It's great to take kids to that. I think our staff and our players who have had the opportunity are always blown away by the level of intensity, the amount of communication that takes place, and the high standards, the accountability. Like those college coaches, they don't miss much in practice, if anything. You know, if you do something wrong, even if it's you're 2 feet away from where you're supposed to be, it's addressed and it's expected that you're going to improve on it. So, you know, I think sometimes kids feel like, oh, I could easily step into the next level, and then they go watch a practice, and it's a different world from the high school game.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I think one of the things that you just said there that always catches my eye is communication. That's a challenge that I think every coach at every level, you can never communicate too much. So whether you're a college coach or you're a high school coach or you're a fifth grade travel coach, you're always trying to get your kids to communicate more. Is there anything that you do with your kids to try to encourage them, to help them to communicate more? How do you go about doing that with your team?
You know, I think it's probably the single hardest thing to get high school kids to do right now. You know, if you let them play defense with their cell phones, I think they'd be comfortable. They can text movements from guys. You know, you take those things out of their hands, and it's sad sometimes, but a lot of guys don't know how to really even interact. You know, if we had a team dinner and we collected cell phones beforehand, I don't think our guys would be comfortable in that environment. So when you take it to a basketball court and you expect constant communication, it is really an uphill battle. And it's something that every year when the season ends, we say we need to do a better job of. And every year when the season starts, it's a priority. And, you know, some years it's better than others. But the biggest thing is early on, it's just stopping practice every time it's not to the level it needs to be. Because the rest of your defense, and I think that's where you see it most, although communication on offense is key, but it doesn't matter how well you close out or how good you are guarding the ball or if you can get to, you know, help or you're sprinting on the flight. If you're not talking, things are going to happen that you can't account for. So that's the biggest thing. And then something we've talked about this offseason that we're actually adding next year is we're going to give guys communication grades, starting with day one of practice, really starting with practice one of this summer. You know, we're going to hand them out a scale of 1 to 5, and these are where your grades would fall, and these are our expectations. And, you know, you can sit and you can have those conversations. Well, today you were a 2. Why was that? What can you do to improve upon it? So giving players that feedback, I think, is also an important part. But it really is at the high school level. That's a challenge, and it's something that you just can't move forward until you get that piece down in the beginning of the season.
Yeah, I love putting that on a scale because I think it brings it down to a concrete level that a kid can understand, because too often – and I know I'm guilty of this as much as anybody is, you know, we say, hey, we want you to talk more. We want you to communicate. And then the kid's kind of looking at you like, okay, but I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be saying or what I'm supposed to be communicating or how I'm supposed to do that. And so a lot of times as coaches, especially coaches who have more experience or who played and kind of, you know, I mean, I'm sure you were the same way when I'm out on the court, whether I'm on offense or defense, like my mouth is running all the time. And so, you know, you kind of take it for granted that I know what to say. I know what I'm looking for. I know what I need my teammates to do. And so I'm constantly doing that. And yet a lot of the kids that we coach don't have that same level of knowledge of the game, or they just don't, they're not as comfortable communicating in that way. And so I think we have to be very conscious as coaches that we're communicating what communication actually means.
Yeah, I think the clearer you are on that, the better you're off with the kids, because it's not something they do naturally. Like if you walked into a rec center and you watched any random group of kids playing basketball, they're not talking on defense. It's just not something that carries over. If you watch some AAU basketball, it's not something that's always emphasized. So it's maybe something they're only going to be asked to do a few months of the year. And we've gone back and forth. You know, when I initially was my first few years, it was, these are the words we're going to say on defense. When you're one pass away, you're going to say this when a screen is coming. And we were very specific with how we wanted the kids to talk and what we expected from them. And I've kind of shifted over the last couple of years to more, you know, communication is more of a conversation. It's not saying deny, deny, or gap when you're one pass away. It's letting your teammate know, you know, this is what's happening behind him, letting your teammates know that this is where you're going to be able to help them. So, you know, we ask more from our guys, just talk to your teammates, let them know what you're seeing, let them know you're there. And that way they're hearing your voice. And I think when they do it, it adds a level of comfortability. But really back to what you said earlier is you're clear about expectations, and this is what good communication looks like. And we've tried a bunch of different things. And you know, I've pulled clips of LeBron James playing defense and how he never shuts up on a basketball court, or Kevin Garnett. And, you know, you could watch him play for 48 minutes and he would never stop talking. So showing them, you know, these are the guys that you look up to. These are the guys you admire. And these are the things that they do. It's not just we're making you do it to do it. If the best player in the world is doing it, it's obviously has some value to it. But I still find it to be one of the most challenging things with high school athletes is getting them to constantly communicate. But as coaches, the minute you allow it to stop, you're probably not getting it back. So it's such a early focus for us that really we don't move out of drills until we get that. And you know, if we're doing a shell drill and a possession goes and we hear silence, we stop and we start it over. And we might not get out of shell for the first 40 minutes of, you know, day one of practice, but we're going to set that foundation early of what we expect. And we're going to give you that feedback on, you know, what you're doing well and where we need to see you improve. But I think you always have to tie it into, why does it matter? You know, where are we going to see the benefits of it on the court? You know, if we're asking you to do something, why is it important? And I think if you can do that, then you get a little more buy-in from the kids.
Yeah, I think the why is key. Do you find yourself, when you're coaching, do you find yourself coaching using questions maybe more than you did in the past, where instead of telling, hey, here's what should have happened, or here's what I saw, and here's what needs to be done, do you find yourself asking after a mistake, like, why did you make that decision, or what could you have done differently, or do you find yourself doing that more?
Yeah, I think two things that I've really tried to do a lot more of, and I think has been a benefit for us and our staff and for our players is, you know, number one, instead of telling the player what they did wrong, asking them what they did. you know, on that possession, where did you err and what could you have done? Because I think if they can discover that on their own, they're going to have a better learning experience than stopping and saying, hey, you closed out high there. Hey, you didn't break down. You know, you didn't make a hard cut. You didn't box out. The player probably knows it might take him a second to get there, but if he can make that realization, I think that's important. And then the other is, you know, as the season goes on, you can't stop every drill for every mistake. You got to kind of let things run. There's got to be a flow to practice. You got to let guys get in their reps. And then you can, at the end of a drill, pull a guy aside and say, hey, you know, this is something I didn't see well. So we kind of try to break it down into three things where, you know, early on, it's really the teaching and the fundamentals of it. And we might stop you every 10 seconds to show you how to do something. And then it might be every couple of minutes within a drill. And then now, you know, you get later in the year, you can let the kids play. And at the end of a 7-8 minute drill, you can point out two or things that you would have liked to seen better while you're maybe communicating throughout the drill. So, you know, I think if you're always stopping guys, you're not getting any repetition. So they're not going to see that improvement. But they do got to hear that message. But a lot of times, you know, kids are smart and they know where they're making mistakes. And if you can get them to pull that information out themselves, I think they're better for it.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I've probably, if I had to define my biggest struggle as a coach, that's always the one that I struggle with the most is how much do I stop it? How much do I let go? When do I step in and make a comment? When do I step in and ask a question? And how do I still maintain that flow of my practices? And I think it's a very, very fine line. I think it's probably different for each coach and each team, and you just kind of got to get to know your kids. But that's one of the things that I think is very difficult. I know you mentioned it when you talked about the, you know, being at a college practice that, you know, things don't slip by. And I know back my very first coaching job was I was the JV coach at Bay back. Whew, it was a long time ago, maybe 93, maybe something like that. And I remember the, you know, we talked about it earlier, coming off your playing career and stepping into that gym, and it was just me and 12 kids. And I remember watching practice for like 5 minutes and being like, oh my God, there was just like 500 mistakes in that 5 minutes. Like, what am I possibly going to do? I'm only one guy. How can I get all this stuff fixed? And just being completely overwhelmed. And obviously as you go along, you get more experience, you kind of figure out when to pick and choose and how to go about doing that. But I think any coach, and especially young coaches, I think probably struggle with the idea of how do I get that flow in my practice and yet still do the coaching and do the correction that I need to do over the course of time.
Yeah. And I think you have to have a focus when you step into every day and really into every drill. You know, you could correct 1,000 different things in a 6-7 minute segment, but the kids can't focus on 1,000 different things. So if you're working on a defensive drill, offense can be a part of it, but you know, here's two or three things that we need to see you do within this drill. And, you know, you might have two coaches watching those things and maybe others just watching the offensive end to see what's going on throughout it. But, you know, if you're telling a kid, you know, you're not closing out, you're not sliding, you got to sprint, you got to talk, you got to box out, his head's going to be spinning. So, you know, maybe what's the most important thing that they're not doing within that segment that you need to see improvement from for him to earn playing time, for us to be more successful in that area, and really limiting the scope of what you're asking for kids. So, I think that goes back to even practice planning. Like if we're going to do a drill, here's two things that I think I want to see out of it. And when you start the drill, tell the kids like, hey, you know, we're going to do this transition drill and I need to see five guys get ahead of the ball. I need to see you find a man, but not necessarily the man that was just guarding you. So, you know, that things that are maybe challenging for high school guys. So we want to see those things and we want to hear talk and we want to see closeouts and we want to see guys sprint on the flight, all those things. But give them the one or two things that are going to be the biggest takeaways. And that way they can focus on what we really want to see improve from that thing. So, you know, with high school kids, and I'm sure maybe you can throw a little more at college guys and NBA guys, you're going to expect everything. But, you know, their level of understanding maybe at 16, 17, 18 years old isn't such that you can focus on transition defense while expecting them to be great in ball screen D in that drill while offensive rebounding and setting screens and all these different things. Now, limit what you want and really expect a high level of execution in those things. And then you can move on to a drill that maybe incorporates everything but focuses on a different aspect. So I think that's something we've changed a lot as we've gone on.
Talk a little bit about your practice planning process, because obviously what you just described goes into putting together a practice that's going to be meaningful and beneficial for your kids and for your team. So talk a little bit about what that process looks like for you and your staff.
You know, it's certainly going to vary depending on the point in the year. You know, the first weeks we might be hitting certain things, or after a game, we might be focused on where we were, you know, where we came up short. But, you know, I think every practice has to focus on, number one, there's got to be skill development in it. And that's another area where early on as a coach, if I had a 2-hour practice, it was 2 hours of drills. You got to, number one, include some things where the kids are going to be, they've got to be shooting the basketball. It's such a huge part of the game. They got to be working on finishing. So we're always going to block some time out in that. And then to me, the biggest area we focus on is the transition part. And part of it's the way we play, but I also think it's maybe the toughest thing to get kids to do well at the high school level is defensively. Transition defense is something I don't think a lot of programs are great at. So we spend a lot of time looking at ways to push the ball in practice, getting it up court, getting up fast, and looking to attack before a defense is set. So we're always going to have a piece of that in practice. And then, you know, it might vary. It might be an offensive focus day. It might be a half court defensive focus, but we try to shift what we're looking at so that kids aren't doing the same thing every day, seeing the same things every day. So we try to vary it up enough to where there's going to be different aspects that we're teaching. And then I would say the thing that every practice has to include is competition. You know, everything's got to be scored. There's got to be a winner and loser. Number one, I think it brings out a different energy in the kids. But if you're going to try to develop a winning team, winning players, and a winning program, well, you got to have winning within practice, and it has to be rewarded, and it has to be emphasized. And so if we're doing a shooting drill, you're competing against somebody else. If we're doing a transition drill, there's going to be a winner and a loser, and there's going to be a reward for winning, or there's going to be a, you know, maybe you're doing a down and back if your team doesn't win. So, you know, we look at all those different things, but it's a process, and it's something that I think is so important to what you do once you get on the court. Like, I've worked for coaches that came to practice without practice plans. And to me, that's one of the most bizarre things I experienced. Like, how are we going to get better if you don't know what we're going to do? And you don't know what we're going to emphasize, and you don't know how much time we're going to spend on things. So, you know, I think if the practice is good, it's because you planned it the right way. And if the practice is bad, it's not the kids' fault. You know, they didn't have energy. They weren't into it. No, you didn't do a good job of getting them into it. You didn't do a good job of making practice fun and exciting and challenging. So, you know, to me, that before you step on the court, you should know if your practice is going to be good because you spent the relevant amount of time putting together that plan that's going to get the most out of the time you have in the gym.
How much time do you typically put into a practice plan for an average practice?
I would say a minimum an hour. You know, I'll typically do it. So if we have a Monday practice, I'll get to school early and I will put together what I think I want to look at and what I want to do. And then I will go back to it during my lunch period, and maybe I'm tweaking this or I'm changing this drill or I'm shifting the order of things. And then I'm going to send it out to my assistant coach, and he's going to look at it, and I'm going to get some feedback from him. And then maybe during my free period at the end of the day, you're going to finalize, or we're going to finalize what exactly it's going to look like. But it is a lengthy process. And I found when I skip on that, you know, we're just going to put it together right before practice. Those are the days where it's not very good. And I think you owe it to the kids to make sure you put in that time. And, you know, early on, I think it was Jim Boone from Delta State said he puts in 2 hours of practice planning for every hour of practice. And I thought, that's crazy. You know, if you're going to practice for 2 hours, you're going to plan it for four. And as you learn more and as you see more, you understand just how vital that is to make sure you have a clear idea of this is what we're going to get better at today. Here's the drills we're going to use to approach it. Here's the things we want to see our team improve upon. And then finding a way to make it all flow. You know, some of the times the quicker you can get guys into practice and enjoying something and doing something competitive, the better attitude and the better energy they're going to have in practice. Because frankly, it's a long year. I mean, if you're having any success, you're playing into March and you're starting in November, and you know, the kids, they don't want to practice too far into January and February. They want to get in and get out and get to the game. So you got to find ways to keep it fresh and keep it exciting. And so I think that's really important too. But, you know, as I've done this longer and longer, that time spent practice planning really pays dividends on the backside of it once you get in the gym and you get going.
Yeah, absolutely. I think no matter what you do, if you're well organized, you're going to end up with a better product at the end of whatever it is that you're doing. I think there's no doubt about that. Would you describe your practices? Are you someone who has a drill and you go through it and you say, we're going to do this until we get this drill right, or we work on and we demonstrate the skills that we're really trying to work on? Or we're doing this drill for 10 minutes, and then when 10 minutes is up, we're moving on to the next thing regardless of kind of where we are with the drill? Because I know there's kind of two competing schools of thought on that.
Yeah, and I would say at different points of the year, I'll approach it in a different way. Early on in the year, we're not going to move on from something until I feel like we've gotten what we need to out of the drill. So we always joke that in the first practice of the year, we might not get out of the first two or three drills because communication doesn't get to where we need to. But as the year moves on, you know, if I have 7 minutes for a drill, 6 minutes for a drill, that's what we're going to spend on it. Now, if it's awful and we really didn't get anything out of that, we may run it back and then say, all right, put the six back on the clock. We're going to do this the right way. But I think, you know, what's worked for me, and maybe it doesn't work for everybody, is, you know, have that flow and continue moving on. And sometimes when you just kind of beat the dead horse, like, all right, we're not getting what we need to out of it. We're just going to stay in it. I've seen our practices bottom out, and you just see the drain on kids. Like, we just want to move on. We want to do something different. So, you know, sometimes if there's a bad drill, I may tweak the practice and say, all right, we're going to go and I'll pull out one of the kids' favorite drills and all right, get practice going back that way. But, you know, for the most part, once we hit January, the practice plan is a practice plan. We'll post it in the locker room. Kids will know what to expect and how long to expect and things. And I think moving from thing to thing really keeps the energy better.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
What's a go-to drill that your kids love that you maybe break out at the beginning of practice or when you're kind of hitting the doldrums?
So one of my favorites, and it just happens to be one of the kids' favorites, is a drill I saw posted by Mike Neighbors, who's the women's coach at Arkansas and used to be the women's coach at Washington. And he plays with pace, and I think he calls it lightning, but we just call it Arkansas transition. We give the kids a 20-second shot clock, and whatever time's left on the clock when you score, that's how many points you get. So if you get it out of the net, kick it up, and you hit a three with 17 seconds left on the shot clock, you get 17 points. So the scoring's outrageous in it. They make wild runs. You know, a four-minute drill, teams may be in the 80s and 90s, and the kids love it, especially when you kind of whitewash somebody and you dominate them for 4 minutes and you look up at the clock and it's 120 to 17. And, you know, guys really enjoy that stuff. But, you know, with the style we've played in the past couple of years, the more up and down – the more transition in the drills, the more the kids enjoy it. You know, we've even gotten to the point, you know, in the last year and a half that we don't really even do anything in the half court. I think the transition part is so important in the game that if we're doing like a 4-on-4 shell, we're going to transition out of it. Or maybe we'll transition into a press and make the offense get the ball in bounds and beat one trap. So we're trying to at least always incorporate that. But the more up and down, man, the kids seem to love that. And sometimes if it's not going well, it might not even be the drill. We'll just grab two guys and say, all right, you're captains, pick teams. We're going to do something and we'll see who wins and who loses. And all of a sudden, you know, you see guys get a little puffed up because maybe they didn't get picked first round or second round, or this guy picks somebody else before him, and it breeds that competition. So, you know, it's different ways, but there are a few go-to drills that our guys have really enjoyed over the years.
I really like the sound of that drill. So I have a question for you. You said something about a shot clock. What's your opinion on a shot clock? Do you think it's going to eventually come to Ohio, or do you think that's a long way out, or would you like to see what it come to Ohio? I guess I should ask.
Yeah, I would love to see it come to Ohio. From the people I talk to, the athletic directors, the officials, it doesn't sound like it's something that's happening in the very near future, but I think at some point it will be universal. I think it adds some really cool elements to the game. You know, I think as a coach, it adds some more strategy to it. As a player, it really rewards guys who can make decisions under pressure, and it puts them in unique situations. But I think most of all, it keeps games going in the fourth quarter. You know, a couple of years ago, we had some great guards, and if we were up six with 4 minutes left, we're going to spread you out, and 2 minutes are going to go off the clock before, you know, we end up breaking you down and getting the layup where you decide to foul. And, you know, as much as that can be an advantage for teams, I don't really think it's the way the game's really meant to be played. So I'd love to see it. I just think it would be so much fun to have. I think the kids would enjoy it. And if we're really doing this for the kids, like, what kid would say, I don't want to play with a shot clock? What kid would say, I really want to be on offense for 90 seconds before we shoot? You know, I'd go lower than the college. I'd go 30 seconds. I'd go 24 seconds. You know, I used to be 35 at the college level. I'm probably a little bit out there and extreme, but to me, the faster the game, the quicker the decisions, the more opportunities the kids have to play and make plays, I think would be a lot of fun.
I mean, I think if you ask those Copley and St. Vincent, St. Mary kids, if they liked that game when they were standing out in the court and holding the ball for 45 seconds to a minute and a half, 2 minutes, and the final score being, what was it, 25 to 20 or something like that. I don't think you're going to ask any of those kids if they had fun that game. I can't imagine that game was fun.
No, my younger brother was actually one of the officials on the game, and I called him afterwards and I said, "So how did it go?" And he said, "Well, it was probably the worst game I've been a part of. Nothing happened." And I get it. Like, Mark Dent's a really smart coach, and he identified a strategy that he thought gave his team the best chance to win. And I give him credit, because I think that's a hard sell to look a locker room full of guys and say, "All right, we're in a district final. We're not going to shoot the basketball." Like, especially the way they play, they get it up and down. They play with good pace. They, you know, they're a lot of fun. And you know, I understand if the coach feels like that gives him the best chance to win, you know, all the power to him. But that's why I'd like a shot clock to be put in, to take that decision out of the coach's hands. And now, all right, you can't slow the game down. And I remember a few years ago, I went to a regional game at Cleveland State, and it was Garfield and Lake. And man, I wanted to walk out at halftime and demand my money back. Like, nobody shot the basketball. And then one team went zone, the other team went zone, both teams held the ball. And you're looking, you know, these guys are playing at Cleveland State with the opportunity to go to Columbus, and they're not getting to do the things that they've done all season. So I get why coaches do it. You want to win. You want to give your kids the best chance to win. If the Federation would just institute the shot clock, that takes that part out of it. Now let the kids play. Like, I don't think there's a single high school player that if you said, do you want a shot clock, they would say no to it. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, let's make the game as fast and as fun as possible. And if we're doing it for the kids, yep, you know, why take away something that could really add to the game? But as a coach, I think it also adds some strategy. It allows you to do some things at end of game situations that you maybe you aren't able to do now. Like, if I'm down 8 with 3 minutes left, I got to start pressing you. And I got to start trapping, and I got to look to start fouling. And if there's a shot clock, you know, maybe I have 3 or 4 more possessions where I can get stops. I can still play the way I want to play, and it keeps you in the game longer. So now the other thing is, you know, the better team's going to win 99 out of 100 times anyway. If you're going to hold the ball on me and my team's better, eventually we're going to get a lead, and you're not going to be able to do that. You know, maybe you can do it for 2 quarters or 3 quarters. Now, if the teams are really close, like Copley and St. V, the gap wasn't really that big, but that kept them in the game. So I get it from a coach's perspective. You want to find a way to win the game for your team, but I just look at it as like, well, how's the game supposed to be played, and what would be the most enjoyable way for it to be played? And to me, that's it. Like, let's let the kids have some fun and get it up and down.
Yeah, any kid wants to play in that kind of style and up-tempo and be able to get shots up, because, again, let's face it, what's fun about the game of basketball for anybody is, you know, you want to score. And when you're forced to hold the ball, you're playing at a slower tempo, it's just not as much fun. And obviously, as you've said, there's some teams and personnel and coaches that, you know, you don't want to play at that pace simply because your players aren't maybe capable of doing that. It doesn't put you in the best position to win. But I think universally, the idea of getting up and down the floor and running and pressing and playing an up-tempo style, I think is, you know, anybody would be in favor of that, again, if it puts you in the best position to win. And if you had the shot clock in place, it would force everybody to kind of get into that up-tempo game and kind of teach that particular style of play and at least adapt to it. So the game would be better off, I think, if we had a shot clock at the high school level.
Yeah, and I agree. And I know you'll hear a lot of anti-shot clock guys say, well, most possessions aren't that length anyway. But if it makes the last 4 minutes of a game better, then what would be the harm to do it? And if you want to control pace, like, you watch Virginia, they have a shot clock, but boy, do they control pace. You know, they take 8 seconds to get across half court. They run that, you know, blocker mover for 10 to 12 seconds, and then they're going to get a shot late in the clock. So good coaches are still going to find ways to control the pace, even if you have a shot clock. And there's plenty of really smart ones in Cleveland who like a slower game, that they'll still be able to do that with a 30 or 35 second clock.
Yeah, no question. You can manipulate the tempo to whatever style that you want to. But to your point, I think in the fourth quarter, it just continues to open up opportunities for a team that's down. And it also doesn't allow the team that's up to just, you know, put it on ice and, you know, spread everybody out and run the clock out. Instead, you got to keep playing basketball, which is ultimately what the game of basketball should be about. Is continue to play the game. I want to touch on, before we start wrapping up, Tony, I want to touch a little bit on your player that you had last year, Sincere Carey, and kind of his recruitment and sort of just the interesting way that came down. And then obviously he had a great freshman year this year. So just, can you talk a little bit about his experience as a high school senior last year for you, and what your experience was like as a coach and his recruitment, and then talk about just the great year that he was able to have in college this year?
Yeah. And I think it was a really unique situation where he had so much success so early, and we had Power 5 schools coming up to Solon to watch him play open gym, to watch him work out. And then he had the knee injury. And I guess I've never seen a recruitment change so fast, where coaches that would have been lucky to get him on the phone or get him on a visit before the knee injury wouldn't even come see him after. You know, I think I'd placed calls to over 300 different coaches, and I couldn't get anyone to watch him because they were afraid of the knee. And then you get a kid where, you know, he's in a situation where, do I play out my senior year? Do I risk it? Or here's West Liberty, this great Division II program that I fit in really well with their style, and I can go start or play right away. And he committed to West Lib, and to his credit, he had such a great senior year, which is what we all expected of him because he's such a phenomenal player, that it no longer made sense for him to go down that path. And I give a ton of credit to the West Lib coaches for allowing him out of his letter of intent. And he was fortunate to land really late with a great coach in Keith Dambrot and Duquesne University. But it was a very bizarre situation because I spent every day in a gym with that kid, and I know the kind of talent he had, the kind of player he was, the kind of person he was, and why college coaches weren't all over him, I'll never understand. And maybe some of it's the way recruiting takes place through the AAU season now, and there's very little done through high schools and the high school coaches. So, you know, maybe they saw something different than what we saw every day. But man, there are a lot of coaches who I've talked to in the last, you know, 6 to 8 months that have said, yeah, man, I wish we would have listened. We missed on that kid, and we would have won a lot more games if we had gotten him. And to their credit, you know, they own a mistake, but man, he was, in my opinion, the best player in the state of Ohio last year. Now you can argue, was he the best college prospect? You know, the Hayes kids at Texas and Goodwin's at Notre Dame. And there were some phenomenal players, and I don't want to take anything away from them, but the way he could control a basketball game and the way he made all of his teammates better, you couldn't game plan around him. He was going to dominate the game, and he was going to do it in a number of different ways. And, you know, we don't come close to the success that we had without him being the type of player that he was. So, you know, I think as well as he played at Atlantic 10, there's really no ceiling to the level he could have played at. But I'm just really happy it worked out where he got a great fit with a coach that understands his type of game and allows him to play with that freedom. And, you know, he played 36, 37 minutes a game as a freshman. So I guess all's well that ends well, but I'll never understand the amount of coaches that passed on a kid that to me just seemed like you can't miss with a kid like that.
Do you think it's a result of, as you mentioned, that so much of college recruiting these days is based on the summer circuit and the AAU spring circuit as opposed to what you see day in and day out as a high school coach? Do you think that's the issue?
I do. I think, you know, I understand that the college coaches could go to a Nike event on the EYBL and they can see two dozen kids that they're looking at over the course of a weekend and they can see them play two or three games. But they're expected to make judgments on kids over the course of two weekends in April and a couple weekends in the summer. And maybe a kid doesn't have a great weekend. Or in his case, maybe, you know, he was coming off a knee injury and he didn't quite have the burst he had. But for coaches to take that little of a snapshot of a player, and it could be any player, not just Sincere, and write him off or move on from him, I just think they're missing the boat. And to me, with the technology we have with huddle and crossover, with coaches having the budgets they have, that there's really, to me, it's confusing why they don't spend more time in high school gyms. You know, 20 years ago, they'd practice in the morning, they'd get in their cars, they'd drive, and they'd go watch a high school game. And that was a big part of their evaluation. And I don't think high school needs to be the only piece, but I certainly think it would be it would behoove a lot of coaches to make it a bigger piece of how they evaluate players. Because what you're going to see in a high school gym is going to be different than what you're going to see in an AAU gym. And maybe roles are different and style of play is different and teammates are different. So to me, you take every opportunity you can to evaluate as many players as you can. And I get it, man. These guys, they have an incredible amount on their shoulders between coaching and developing relationships with their players and their boosters and their, you know, pumping up their programs and their communities. But a kid like Sin doesn't get missed on if the AAU situation isn't the way it is right now. It just isn't. Because if anyone would have come seen him play as a junior or as a sophomore or as a senior, you know, they're offering on the spot. He was just that dominant of a player. And now, you know, you see college coaches in the gym more after a guy commits, trying to make sure they keep that, you know, they're seeing, they keep that relationship
right.
than when they were evaluating him. So it's different. And, you know, I don't want to be someone who's knocking AAU because I think there's so many great things that come out of AAU, especially at the high level that that some of these kids get the opportunity to play at. They see the best players in the country. Hopefully it's motivating, it's humbling, it's an experience they'll never forget. But if you're telling me you're going to build your roster based on guys you've seen play for 2 to 3 weeks, maybe that's why there's so many transfers, or at least a part of the reason why so many kids are leaving, and maybe players aren't what the coaches thought. Maybe coaches aren't what the players thought. So I think there's ways to do it. And I think there's probably coaches that do a great job of balancing the two, but there's certainly coaches that I know that do it all during the AAU cycle. And as a high school coach, I think you'd want to know. And frankly, I've had 3 players in the last 2 years commit on full scholarship, and I've only talked to one of their college coaches before.
That's amazing to me. And I think
that's crazy.
What always strikes me with this issue is that when you play in an AAU tournament, I get the idea that you're playing against high level competition. So if you're a sincere carry and you're playing in an average high school game, you know, he's better than those kids that he's playing against, and he's better than those kids that he's playing with. And so I understand that point when you put him in a, you know, in a situation where he's playing with other players that are on his level, that gives you a chance to evaluate him in a slightly different way. However, to me, if I look at myself, if I'm a college coach, the program that I'm going to bring him into is going to be a program, it's going to be a practice, it's going to be a game situation that is going to be far more similar to his high school experience than it is to his AAU experience in terms of fitting into a team, being a teammate, all those sort of intangible things that I think you don't see in an AAU game, simply because, again, the teams are just kind of thrown together. And yeah, maybe you're practicing, but it's still, in a lot of cases, it's an all-star team and guys are just kind of doing their own thing. Yeah. Whereas on the high school level, you're seeing what the guy looks like in a system. And to me, when you bring a kid into your college program, he's going to play in a system. Now, the system might not be the same as it was in high school, but you're going to get a lot better read from watching the kid play in high school, and you're going to get a lot better read on the type of kid he is and the type of person he is by talking to the high school coach and finding out. And so I continue to be amazed by the fact that so much of the recruiting has shifted to the AAU circuit, and that, you know, to hear you say that you only talk to one of the 3 head college coaches of your guys, that's amazing to me.
Yeah, I mean, I get the AAU scene. You know, you can watch 10 Division I players at a time rather than come and watching them at Solon, where he might be the only one on the court. But I think there's value in both. And if you're only doing part of it, and, you know, even if you were only watching high school and you're not watching AAU, you're missing out on a piece. But I think the recruitment of players has changed. I think the process has changed. A lot of it, or so much of it now, is coaches go through the AAU guys because they have those relationships with them. Those guys are a part of the program for years and years. But yeah, I mean, when I share that story that 2 of my guys were offered, committed, and I had never even spoken to the college coach, to me, that's a head scratcher. Wouldn't you want to know what I think of a guy before you offer him, you know, $150,000, and you bank your job on his ability to help you win games at that next level?
You would certainly, you know, think so.
if my ability to feed my family is based on wins and losses, I'm going to talk to every person I can, coach, teacher, principal, athletic director. And that's really, that's probably been the most surprising change from when I started 13 years ago to now, is that in a lot of situations, the high school coaches aren't a part of the process. And that's okay. I don't, you know, it's not an ego thing. I don't need to be a part of it. But man, I could sure tell you some things about my players that maybe you won't see in an AAU weekend. And I can sure tell you some things that maybe they don't get to show because they have a different role with my team than maybe they do with their AAU team. So I think you get as much information as you can, and that way you make the best decision that you can. But I don't know that it's changing back. I know there's been some push and there's been some rule changes, and they're trying to give it back a little bit to high school coaches. But, you know, I think it's probably headed to a place that's going to stay where the ball's in the AAU court. So, you know, I hope my kids find the right teams where they get to showcase and they get to play a lot, because you could be on a shoe team, and if you're the 9th guy, what are you going to show?
Yeah, you're not getting much opportunity. That's one of the things.
So the decisions of who they play for and what tournaments they go to are so important. And that's really become a new responsibility for me as a high school coach. I got to learn as much as I can about where and when my kids should be playing and with what programs are going to give them the best opportunities. And, you know, it's just a new responsibility, and you try to gather as much information as you can to hopefully put them in the best positions they can, because that's where the looks and that's where the offers are coming from now.
No question about that. Tony, we're going to wrap up here. I want to give you a chance to share out your contact information so the people who have listened to the podcast that want to reach out to you, maybe they have a question or just want to shoot you a line, can do that. And then if there's anything else that we didn't touch on tonight that you want to share before we get out of here, go ahead and do that as well.
You know, if you want to reach me on Twitter, it's at Coach DeCesar, DeCesare. Email's AnthonyDeCesar@SolonBOE.org. And if you have any questions, comments, you want me to share anything with you, you just want to tell me I'm awful. Those are great ways to get in touch with me and do that. And I'm open to any of it. And I appreciate you guys letting me come on and talk some hoops and share some Solon basketball stories. And it's always fun to be a part of, you know, spreading the game, and what you guys do is great. I've listened to a lot of your shows and will continue to, and I always pick up a little nugget from each one.
Well, we appreciate that, Tony. It's been a pleasure having you on, getting a chance to pick your brain, talk a little high school hoops, and learn about the crazy college recruiting process. So yeah. We can't thank you enough for spending an hour and 15 minutes with us tonight. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.